Those of us who practice wisdom are excellent contemplators of nature and everything she contains. They examine the earth, the sea, the sky, the heavens, and all their inhabitants. They are joined in thought to the sun, moon, and all the other stars, both fixed and wandering. And although they are attached to the earth by their bodies, they provide their souls with wings, so that they may walk on the ether and contemplate the powers that live there, as is fitting for true citizens of the world. It goes without saying that such people, rejoicing in their virtues, make of their whole lives a festival. So there's some words, lovely words, aren't they, of a sort of vision of what human beings could be. There's some words from the ancient philosopher Philo of Alexandria. And Manjugosha is a figure that's particularly associated with wisdom. So I wanted to start with this quote about wisdom from an ancient pagan tradition. I want to move on to a more contemporary sort of reference from our sort of culture. A few years ago, I like going to see films, and I sort of enjoy all sorts of films, not just serious films. I would like to have talked about Toy Story 3, which I think is a very Dharmic film. But I'm not going to talk about Toy Story 3. I'm going to talk about another film that I saw a few years ago, actually with Brian, who's sitting over there, a film called Sunshine by Danny Boyle. And some of you may have seen it. And it's a sort of, it's a science fiction film in the sort of mode of serious science fiction films. And I went to see it with Brian, and I enjoyed it. It's a sort of thriller, and at one level, it's just an enjoyable, thrilling, visually very beautiful film. But what I was struck by was that in the days and weeks and even months that followed my seeing the film, the images stayed with me, and they wouldn't go away, and they'd appear in my meditation. And particularly what would appear was an image of the sun. In the film, it's set sometime in the future, and the sun is dying for some reason. And inhabitants of Earth, eight inhabitants, have undertaken a mission to journey in a spacecraft to the sun. And on their spaceship, I mean, the front of the spaceship, there's this giant, beautiful gold shield that protects them from the heat and the light of the sun. And on the back of the spaceship is a huge bomb, the size of Manhattan, we're told, a nuclear device that they're going to eject into the heart of the sun and explode it in an attempt to restart the sun. Yeah, and so they're on their way to the sun on this voyage, and things start to go wrong. As they would, as it were. All sorts of kind of logistical problems arise. And being on the team of this retreat, I sort of know how they feel. apart from, for us, the logistical problems haven't resulted in any serious kind of casualties, whereas in the film, in Danny Boyle's film, they start to die. They start to die in different ways. And all the deaths are somehow associated with the sun, or with their sort of mission to the sun. And all the time, they're fascinated by what they're moving towards. And you see, in glorious colour, this beautiful orange sphere, this vast, awesome, wondrous star that is, in a way, the source of all life on Earth. It's that star that they're heading towards, and yet, if they just get out of line with it, if they dare to look at it, it burns them. It burns them, destroys them, it kills every living thing that comes too close. Their spacecraft is called Icarus, to remind them not to get too close to the sun. And I was just very struck by this image, because it's a sort of universal image, the sun, isn't it? It's a universal image, but particularly the sun as seen from outer space, which we've only been able to capture in images relatively recently. This fiery, beautiful disk that hangs in this infinite space. And is somehow the centre of all things. It's the centre of our solar system, and in a way, the source, as we say, of all energy, of all life. For me, that had a resonance with the Buddha. It had a resonance immediately with the Buddha, who is often likened to the sun. It had a resonance because the Buddha is said to be the centre of the spiritual universe. He is the source of all spiritual life. He gained enlightenment on a mythic spot called the Vajrasana. And the Vajrasana is said to be the diamond throne at the centre of the spiritual universe. We have a retreat centre called Vajrasana after that mythic spot. Ours happens to be in Bury St Edmunds. but nevertheless, Vajrasana is this mythic centre of the universe. But there's more. There's something about the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha himself, which is devastating, which is terrifying. We heard about Vajrapani last night. There's something about the Buddha's wisdom, which is awesome in all senses of the word. And my sense is that I can't look at the Buddha's teaching directly. I can't understand what the Buddha's saying directly, because it's too threatening. It's too threatening to my sense of self. It's too threatening to the man that I like to think I am. It's too threatening to take on the truths of the Dharma. And yet, I feel compelled to move towards them. I feel compelled to move towards them, knowing that in a certain sense, they'll destroy me. If I can touch them, they'll destroy everything that I think of as mine and as me. So I find that analogy particularly potent, the analogy of the sun. In the film, they have filters. They become obsessed, especially one of the characters becomes obsessed with just staring at the sun, looking at the sun. They all actually become slightly mesmerised by it. Of course, they can't look at it directly, but they have filters that block out most of the light. It blocks out 98% of the light, so they can just see 2% of the light, and that's what their eyes are capable of seeing without going blind. And the 2% of the light shows this incredibly beautiful, incredibly vibrant orange disc that fills the entire field of view, their entire field of view. At one point in the film, you have Mercury cross the sun. The transit of Mercury crosses the sun, and Mercury is this tiny dot against this vast radiant furnace. So the filters are how they can look at the sun. When one of the characters removes the filters, he has to sort of for plot reasons, and as it were. He sort of sits down, knowing that this is the last thing he's going to see. And the filters, the computer removes the filters. and there's this blaze of whiteness. And not only whiteness that's too bright to look at, but this wave of wind and energy that just comes right through and blows him away, literally. So yes, the filters enable the others to look at the sun and to wonder at the sun, to approach it. And for me, Manjidosha is in a way the approach to the sun that I can use. I can't look at the Buddha directly. I would, as I say, not know how to without burning. But Manjidosha is what appears when I try to look at the sun. And he's filtered through in a way reality so that it's accessible to us in a human form. So he's this figure that is incredibly beautiful. He's beautiful in a mesmerizing way. He's a young man, he's a youth, he's a prince. He's made of orange light, not just orange, but amber. It's said to be like honey held up to the sun. And he's made of this scintillating orange light and clad in silks and jewels, sort of appropriate to the prince that he is. And he's incredibly kind. He looks at you with great compassion. He sits on a pale blue lotus flower, a perfect pale blue lotus that floats in the infinite dark blue cosmos. And he holds in his hand, in his right hand, he holds above him aloft, wielding a sword. And it's a sword that's on fire. It's a flaming sword. There are flames all the way on the blade of the sword, and it's glinting with those flames. The handle of the sword is a vajra. The vajra is the diamond scepter of reality, the diamond thunderbolt of reality. He holds this aloft, but very, very delicately. It's like he's just balanced in his hand with two fingers and his thumb. Very, very delicately, like it's sort of just dancing above him. And then in his left hand, to his heart, he holds a book. He holds a book. And it's the book of wisdom. It's the book of ultimate wisdom. It's the book of the perfection of wisdom. His name, Manju Gosha, Manju is gentle, pleasing, kindly. And Gosha is voice. So he's the gentle-voiced one. He's the gentle-voiced one. And I find him intriguing because, yes, he is gentle. And that's really emphasized with Manjudosha. He's kindly, he's compassionate, he's beautiful, he's infinitely attractive, he's rich. He is the embodiment of all the Buddha's wisdoms. He is the complete embodiment of wisdom. And yet, he's holding this sword, which is devastating. It's devastating. And he's smiling and almost inviting us to approach him, and in a way submit to his sword. So, in my imagination, I find that an extremely compelling image, a completely inspiring image. But I'm going to move on from Manjudosha and then come back to him later. I want to talk more generally about the imagination and its relationship to wisdom. So as we've been emphasising, as Jayaka and Subhadramati, as our other speakers have been emphasising, the imagination is a vital, vital faculty in Buddhism. It is the faculty in Buddhism. It's not mere fancy. It's not child's play. It's the fusion of us, all our faculties, at their highest. It's the fusion of our reason, our emotion, our intuition, our volition, all fused in one single faculty that can apprehend reality directly. So in a way, imagination is too poor a word for it. When we talk about it, we talk about it with a capital I, trying to, in a way, distinguish it from common usage of the word. So yes, imagination is vital, and we need to learn how to develop it and to take it seriously. But imagination is also a potentially dangerous thing. It's a potentially dangerous thing. Images are dangerous things. Vajrapani last night was a dangerous thing. Some of you have felt his presence today, and it's not comfortable. But at least Vajrapani, the image of Vajrapani, is in service of the highest good. Not all images are in service of the highest good. So we have to be careful about images. We have to be careful about this faculty of the imagination. Just at a mundane level, we know that in our society, marketing and advertising use images. The marketing and advertising people know of the power of images and use them to stimulate, you could say even manipulate, us into consuming more. And you could say, okay, well, that's still a relatively benign thing, or at least you could say that unless you start to really reflect on what our consumerist capitalist society is becoming. But you think about other ideologies that we've known through history and still know through history. Communism, fascism, religious fundamentalism of all kinds. And all ideologies use images to motivate us into acting and believing in certain ways. People know that images speak to us very deeply. And we have to be careful as to what images we let in and also how we interpret them. How we interpret them is really critical. So last night, Vidyadhara evoked very eloquently and powerfully this figure of Vajrapani. In another tradition, you'd think, well, he was just some sort of demonic force let loose. And as he said, what is he doing on a Buddhist retreat, this demonic force? Buddhism doesn't see him in that light because it uses that image in a symbolic way to point to the darkest, deepest, most potent, powerful, potentially transforming aspects of our mind and says, look, this image can release those forces into the service of the good, into the service of the Dharma. But you need to understand the concepts of Buddhism in order to relate to the image in an appropriate way. Images left on their own float away and are hostages to whatever ideology wants to make use of them. Yeah? And we need to be careful about that. So we need concepts and we need reason. We need to understand with our critical faculty what is going on. And on this retreat, we need to be questioning what our understanding of the Dharma is, what our understanding of the Buddha's Dharma is, in order to relate in an appropriate way to the images. And I know many of you have been doing that. Certainly you've been doing that when I've had conversations with you, individually or in groups. So what Buddhism would say is that we need to look at our views. We need to look at what we believe in and how our beliefs, our views, how they shape and govern our actions, our behaviour, our lives. we need to look at our views, because some views are unhelpful if we're trying to grow spiritually, if we're trying to move in the direction of the sun, if we're trying to move in the direction of the Buddha and his enlightenment. Some views hold us back. Other views will help us along the way. They'll help us actually have the courage, the determination, the kindness and the awareness to tread what is a difficult and demanding path. So some views are very helpful, some views are unhelpful. The unhelpful views traditionally are called wrong views, and helpful views are called right views. But they're not wrong or right in the sort of absolute literal sense. They're either helpful or unhelpful. Ultimately, Buddhism says, all views are provisional. They're all provisional. Because reality, if we could stare at the sun nakedly, all views would drop away. If we could really look at the potent force of reality in all its awe, there wouldn't be a view in our mind. There wouldn't be room for a view. Yeah? So we need to, in a way, hold all our views, including the views that Buddhism says are helpful, we need to hold them provisionally, not literally. We need to hold them as means to an end. And Buddhism's very, very sophisticated and clear about this. It's us that get it wrong. It's us that literalize things and say, Buddhism tells me I can't smoke or whatever it is. It's actually much more sophisticated than that, much more intelligent than that. So I want to look at unhelpful views. I want to look at helpful views. And I want to look at what arises or what might arise beyond all views, beyond any sort of categorization. And I want to do that, I want to explore that by looking at three aspects of Manjigosha. Manjigosha, who teaches us to move towards the sun, who teaches us his wisdom through helping us purify our views. So the first aspect of Manjigosha that I want to look at is his sword, his flaming sword that he wields above his head. And the sword, you could say, is there to cut down the thicket of our unhelpful views, of our wrong views. The sword completely slices through them effortlessly. It's said that it destroys all pain, because unhelpful views ultimately lead to suffering. Helpful views lead us beyond suffering. So the sword is associated with this cutting away of wrong views. And all wrong views ultimately arise, according to Buddhism, from our self-clinging. We may be really sophisticated in our rationalization of what we believe. But Buddhism says all our theories, all our sophisticated philosophies arise from our egotism, from our self-clinging. They have an emotional basis at their core. They're survival strategies. They're not these sophisticated edifices of truth. So I just want to look at a couple maybe, wrong views, two or three wrong views that I feel infected by in our culture, personally infected by in my life, and they're so sort of prominent in the world that they're sometimes difficult to see how deep they go. The first of these is materialism. Materialism in the sense of scientific materialism, which says that matter is all there is, and matter is just an inert substance that makes up the world, the universe, us, and that is all there is. Materialism, from a Buddhist point of view, is a nihilistic view. It's nihilistic because it says there's nothing beyond this physical form and this physical material existence. And when this body dies, that's it, the lights go out. And you may say, okay, well, what's wrong with that? What happens if you buy into materialism more and more is that it undermines value. It undermines meaning. It undermines purpose, or at least in the sense of a higher purpose. What it tends to leave in its place is a purpose that's, the lowest common denominator of human existence, which is just material comfort and pleasure. Material comfort and pleasure become the purpose of our existence, the purpose of our culture, the purpose of our society. And if you think that you don't buy into materialism, well, just think again as to how we behave. How we behave. Because views aren't always consciously held. They appear in our behaviour. So I like to think of myself as somebody who doesn't buy into materialism. And I find myself wandering into the Apple Mac store in Covent Garden and buying into materialism. The Apple Mac store in Covent Garden is a temple to materialism. It's beautiful. And they're friendly. They serve. It's an experience. I sort of arm health recommending it, I guess, as an experience. But the invention of the iPhone cannot be the ultimate achievement that human beings are capable of, can it? It cannot be what we're meant to be doing with our lives. It can't be that the possession of such a thing is the highest human happiness, the highest human gain. And yet, we build a culture as if it is. That's what we do. I went into the store, I was showing them my Mac, I wanted something for it. I have an image of Mandragosha, I'm afraid, on my screensaver, on my Mac. As a sort of reminder that, I don't know, it's a sort of corrective in my imagination. And the man looked at me and said, oh, you're a Buddhist. And I said, yes. And he said, oh, Steve Jobs is a Buddhist. And we got into this little conversation about Buddhism. And I'd really like to have a conversation with Steve Jobs and say, what sort of Buddhist are you? You know, it'd be nice to know. He's the founder of Apple. Very, very wealthy man. In buying into materialism, one of the things that we lose, I think we lose very quickly, is our sense of reverence. In our culture, in our society, I don't think I see much sense of reverence. If you go to a traditional society like India, I'm Indian, but I've never lived in India, but I've visited India, and I'm really struck by how this culture of reverence is really alive in India. That's not to say that that's always a good thing, there's lots of problems with it, etc. But there is something about people being very quick to look up to higher values and even embodiments of higher values. But there's another danger. There's another danger which feels to me just as dangerous. And this is the view that we are created by some sort of divine being, a divine creator God, that we have an essential soul, that God can save or punish or redeem or whatever. Yeah? A creator God who stands outside of the universe, acts as a judge, and can arbitrarily, almost, decide on our fate, and that we have some sort of eternal essence within us that will have some sort of eternal destiny. That, too, is to me a very, very dangerous view. In a way, you just have to look at the religious fundamentalism and the wars going on all around us. Britain, we're lucky, aren't we? But you look elsewhere in the world, and the Middle East particularly comes to mind, and it's the most dangerous place, probably, for us, as a species, I think. And it's fueled by religion. It's fueled by religion. I'm not saying it's just the Judeo-Christian religions. Hinduism has an eternal creator God, and it means that you are, if you're one of the millions of people who are born so-called into the ex-untouchable or the untouchable community or the caste, then you're condemned to a life of oppression and poverty and slavery because God willed it. There was a recent debate by amongst Tony Blair and Christopher Hitchens. I don't know if you saw it. They met in Canada. Christopher Hitchens is, I don't know of him really, I had not read him, but he's a writer, a journalist. And he and Tony Blair were publicly debating about God, whether God, the notion of God, was a beneficial thing, whether that was good for the world. And Christopher Hitchens is dying. I mean, he's terminally ill. I don't know what with, but he's dying. And this is what he said. Once you assume a creator and a plan, it makes us objects in a cruel experiment whereby we are created sick and commanded to be well. Created sick and then ordered to be well. And over us, to supervise this, is installed a celestial dictatorship, a kind of divine North Korea. I like that. So, now of course that's only one view of theistic religions. I know that many, many people who follow theistic religions would have a much, much more sophisticated and nuanced notion of how they see God. And in a way that's great. That's great because I think that's probably much closer to the truth. But you still have millions of people who do see God as this divine creator and in this cruel experiment. And that causes untold suffering in the world. I have a terrible need. Shall I say the word? Of religion. Then I go out at night and paint the stars. That's something that is a quote from Van Gogh, which I came across and was immediately struck with. I have a terrible need, shall I say the word, of religion. Then I go out at night and paint the stars. And for me, that evokes something of what Buddhism does. It meets this terrible need in us of religion. In a certain sense, Buddhism isn't a religion, but we don't have a word for it. But it meets that need in us, which is a human need. It speaks to our potential, and it inspires us to become more than we are. It inspires the creativity in us to bloom. It invites us to go out at night and paint the stars. And I think that that's what all human beings need to aspire to. Whether they call it Buddhism, whatever they call it, we need it. We all need it. So Buddhism would say there's this middle way over and above these two polar opposite wrong views of nihilism and materialism and eternalism and theism. It would say there is another way that you can revere and respond to the mystery of the universe, of life, and use that reverence to enhance your life, enhance your being, enhance your consciousness, and help others do the same. There is this, in a way, third possibility over and above the other two. But before I talk more about what Buddhism says about the nature of reality, if you like. I was just thinking there are other sort of wrong views, one or two others that I just want to touch on. By the way, is anybody really hot in here? Yeah. Do you want the door open? Shall we open the door? Just for a bit. Thank you, Julie. So, egotism gets in everywhere and starts to dictate our lives. One manifestation of that is an inflation, a pride that Vidyadhara alluded to in that story last night, thinking that we're the best thing ever, thinking that we're already at the top of the game, that there's nothing to look up to because we're it. I was thinking, surely nobody quite holds that view in that sort of literal way. And then I was watching The Apprentice. I don't know if you've seen The Apprentice. And you think, oh my goodness, there are these young, intelligent men and women thinking they're it, particularly one of them. I can't remember his name. But then the opposite. Opposite is also damaging. Thinking that we're worthless. Thinking that we're not worthy of doing anything with our lives, that we're not up to it. Everybody else is, but we're not. I can remember coming along to the Buddhist Centre, the LBC, and feeling that everybody else was a devout Buddhist who meditated every day for at least 50 minutes, and I might have managed 30 minutes once a week, and was probably out down the pub with my mates most of the other time. And feeling, really being drawn to the Buddhist Centre and feeling, well, how can I show my face there? How can I turn up to a class, a meditation class? I'm not worthy. Equally damaging. Buddhism would say, look, let's just take responsibility for our minds in an adult way. Yeah? We're not awful. None of us. Nor are we the best thing ever. None of us. We're human. We're not perfect. And that's fine. That's fine. Particularly that's fine if we're trying to grow, if we're trying to develop, if we're working on ourselves, and if we're trying to make some sort of positive contribution to life around us. That is fantastic. Yeah, that's all that there is, in a certain sense. Yes, there is this incredible lofty ideal, and yet we don't have to get there all in one step. So Buddhism would say take responsibility. But taking responsibility is a challenging thing to do, because what it means is that there's no room for blame. Buddhism is uncompromising about this. Jayaka earlier on was asking us in this room to just sit with whatever arose in our experience. That is part of what taking responsibility means. It means not resorting to blame. Blame can go both ways. We can either blame ourselves, I'm not worthy, I'm at fault, I'm an idiot, or I'm bad in some way, or it's the other person's fault, the other people's fault. Often on retreats like this, although I'm pleased to see that it doesn't happen with you lot, it's the team's fault. It's the team's fault that it's snowing or that it's thawed or whatever it is. We blame so easily, don't we? We live in this culture of blame, ourselves or other people. Buddhism's saying that's just silly. It doesn't help. For a start, it doesn't help. Never mind whose fault it is. What are you doing with your mind? What are we doing with our minds? That is our point of freedom. That is our locus of responsibility. Are we taking responsibility for our minds, our responses? And Buddhism is saying, if we do that, we will experience freedom. We will experience freedom. So in a way, I'm just pointing out some of the views that are so endemic that this sword of Manjigosha is trying to sever. If you let this sword near you, you'll feel the singeing of its flames. I want to move on then to more helpful views. What are more helpful views? And here I want to, in a way, urge us to imagine Manjigosha's voice. It is the most beautiful voice that you've ever heard. It is the most gentle, seductive, mesmerizing, charismatic, velvety voice that you've ever heard. And yet, it also is like a roar, like a thundering roar that whispers at you, and yet you can't escape from. So this incredible voice that is like no human voice that we've ever heard. And that voice is teaching us helpful views. That's how I like to see it. That voice is teaching us views that will lead us towards the truth, towards enlightenment, towards this experience where all views drop away. So the first thing Manjugosha's voice teaches us, the first thing he says to us, is that there are no fixed essences in the universe. We, nor anything else in the universe, are not fixed essential things. There's no such thing as things. We are all processes, always moving. There's nothing fixed about us. There's nothing fixed about the stars, the cosmos, anything around you. This notion that things are fixed and solid is illusory, and we base our lives on it at our peril, on that illusion. What's more, not only is everything not fixed, everything arises because of conditions caused by other processes, if you like. Everything's in a conditional relationship with other things. So nothing is separate from its environment. Nothing is separate from its environment. And I don't mean just the immediate environment. The sun is 93 million miles away. Of course we're dependent upon it. How can we say that it doesn't condition our lives? It's just conditioned the fact that, you know, there's thaw now. And it nearly conditioned the fact that this retreat didn't happen at all. 93 million miles away, it's influencing us. So nothing, me, you, anything else in the universe, is isolated, nor is it fixed and unchanging. So you might say, okay, well, fair enough, what's the point? You know, so that all sounds lovely, but let me unfold some of the implications more. So the first thing is that the implication is that the cosmos is not a random process. Things happen because of conditions. It's not random, and therefore it's not meaningless. If it was random and meaningless, there could be no notion of spiritual development. Not only isn't it random, but we can start to detect the conditioned laws that operate in the cosmos. There are laws that seem to govern how things unfold, how things grow, how things decay. There are laws. And if we can understand those laws, we can cooperate with them. And some of those laws are the laws that lead us to Buddhahood, lead us to staring nakedly at the sun. So I'm going to just outline a model that comes from the Buddhist tradition, but it's also a model that has been particularly emphasized, enhanced and developed by Sangharakshita, who is the founder of the Triratna Buddhist community. And it's a model of five different types of laws, five different types of conditioned relationships that operate in the cosmos. They're called the five niyamas. I really, really love this model, by the way, but you'll have to bear with me to before I can enthuse about it. The first set of laws are the laws that govern inanimate matter, or what we think of as inanimate matter, because actually Buddhism says nothing is inanimate, ultimately. But what we think of as inorganic matter, that might be a better way of putting it. This lectern, this floor, these walls, these buildings, the snow outside. There are laws that govern matter. And Buddhism doesn't investigate those laws, but modern science does, particularly the science of physics and inorganic chemistry, geology, investigate these laws. what Buddhism would say is that there are certain laws, and then it moves on. And it says that when matter becomes, when the conditions are right, when matter becomes complex enough because the conditions are right, something new emerges and another set of conditioned relationships come into operation. And these are the relationships, the laws, the regularities that govern life. So when matter clusters and the conditions are right, when there's sufficient whatever it is that forms life, a new type of relationship comes into being and something else happens and we get the phenomena of life. And it's a mystery why that happens, but it happens and we see it happening. So botany, biology, organic chemistry, zoology are the studies in Western terms of these laws and relations. And Buddhism would say they exist. It doesn't investigate them, but it says, yes, there are these relations. When life becomes complex enough, evolved enough, to support instincts, when animals start to form instincts, some other laws start to come into operation. They're the laws that govern mind, instinctive mind. So you get this phenomena that we call mind, seemingly appearing to evolve out of life. But once it has evolved, it obeys its own patterns and regularities. We have it. We have an instinctive mind that we share with the rest of the animal world. Animals have it in terms of survival instinct, in terms of knowing what's food, what's not food, what's threatening, what's a mate, etc., etc. And those instincts can be very sophisticated, or lead to at least sophisticated behaviours. Penguins do incredible things, don't they, when it comes to trying to mate. for some reason, that's their instinct, yeah? And that is the law of mind. Mind is in operation there. Again, Buddhism doesn't look at it too closely. It does acknowledge that, yes, these laws exist. So these first three niyamas, as they're called, the Pali word is uttu niyama for the physics, the matter thing, bija niyama for life, the regularities that determine life, bija meaning seed, and mano niyama, mano meaning mind. But then something crucial happens in evolution. And what happens is that you get, at a certain point, mind becomes, or consciousness becomes, sophisticated enough, form perhaps has become sophisticated enough in terms of brains, it becomes sophisticated enough to offer us self-consciousness, reflexive consciousness. And that's what we have as human beings. We have self-consciousness. We have the awareness that we're aware. Yeah? We have reflexive consciousness. It's the reflexive consciousness, the awareness that I am aware, that you are aware, it's that that enables us to work on our own minds. So when in meditation we start looking at our experience, when we become mindful of our thoughts, our emotions, etc., what we're doing is using this faculty of reflexive self-awareness. We're using our mind to look at our mind. We're using awareness to look at this phenomena of awareness. And when we do that, it means that we can develop our minds deliberately. We don't have to then wait for biological evolution to develop our consciousness. We can work on our own consciousness. And that's where Buddhism becomes really interested, because it says there are certain laws that govern the development of consciousness. If you know those laws, you can cooperate with them, you can grow. You can grow in the sense of you can grow your mind, your being, in terms of consciousness. And this is called the karma niyama. So karma means action. And the karma niyama are the set of actions that govern the unfolding of consciousness in this reflexive self-conscious sense. And what Buddhism says in terms of the karma niyama, and I'm going to have to be relatively brief, is it says that our actions shape our minds. Our actions shape our minds. So if we act with greed and hatred and unawareness, that will shape the consciousness that arises in the future. It's as if consciousness is arising afresh every moment, but it's determined or it's conditioned by the habits, the habitual, intentional, volitional actions that we've done in the past. And if we've acted from greed and hatred habitually, that's the sort of consciousness that arises afresh in the next moment. Those habits then become character. They become our nature. And then we're in this a circle of acting from them evermore.
Yeah.
Conversely, we can break habits. Or if we start to act from generosity, from love, from kindness, from metta, from awareness, from mindfulness, from energy that's pursuing the good, then our consciousness unfolds in a richer way. It unfolds in a way that will feel more fulfilling, feel more meaningful, where life becomes richer, more beautiful. That's what we're doing on this retreat. We're unfolding our consciousness by acting in particular ways. Meditation builds on that ethical behaviour and works directly on the mind. So ethics and meditation unfold consciousness. So if you feel, even if you've only been here 2 days, if you feel brighter, more alive, more relaxed, more positive, more in connection with other people, that is not a coincidence. That's because you have worked on your mind over the last number of days. Yeah? And that's powerful. That's powerful. Also, what I really like about this model is that it says that not everything that happens to us is a result of our actions. So the snow falling and delaying the team arriving, I don't believe was because I or anybody on the team had been particularly naughty. So not everything that happens is a result of our actions. Because you've got these other processes, these other niyamas, the physical, the organic, the life, etc., also operating. So Buddhism is very sophisticated about this. It's saying that there are certain actions that will determine our experience, and there are other experiences that we have that aren't determined by our actions. Yeah. Now, this model, the reason I like this model is it places the spiritual life in this vast evolutionary context. It says that what we're doing is natural. Just as life has emerged from matter, mind has emerged from life, self-consciousness has emerged from mind, so spiritual development is a natural next step for the human being. Yeah? And Buddhism isn't just an arbitrary thing, it is what we naturally want to do, need to do. Okay, I'm going to move on, and I'm going to try and move a bit quickly. So in a way, that's a helpful model. That's a helpful model that Manju Dosha's voice is trying to teach us. I now want to look at the book that he holds in his... Well, he holds it in his left hand, the Book of Wisdom. The Book of Wisdom points beyond all models. It points beyond even the helpful ones. Let me just read you this. What an astonishing thing a book is. It's a flat object made from a tree with flexible parts on which are imprinted lots of dark, funny little squiggles. But one glance at it and you're inside the mind of another person, maybe somebody dead for thousands of years. Across the millennia, an author is speaking clearly and silently inside your head directly to you. Writing is perhaps the greatest of human inventions, binding together people who never knew each other, citizens of distant epochs. Books break the shackles of time. A book is proof that humans are capable of working magic. Isn't that great? I really like that. That's Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan was a scientist, an astronomer, a sort of childhood hero of mine. A cosmologist. I'm going to quote him a bit more. Manju Dosha holds the book that allows us to communicate with the mind of enlightenment, not just an ordinary human mind, but the mind of enlightenment. It's the perfection of wisdom, beyond all concepts, beyond them, not beneath them. Transcending concepts. And ultimately we have to do that. We have to transcend all our views, as I say. But the point that I want to make is that it's really easy, and I've heard it in popular Buddhist circles, to say concepts are not needed because ultimately Buddhism is saying they're all provisional. So why don't I just leave behind all concepts and just be? And that's just nonsense. That's just nonsense because Buddhism says that it's very difficult, almost impossible, to move from our position of holding unhelpful views to not holding any views at all. We need to move through the position of right view, of helpful view. Right view is the bridge between no view and wrong view, or wrong view and no view. We can, of course, have flashes and glimpses of insight, as it's called, where reality just seems to dawn in our minds and we see things brightly and clearly. But if we want to live by those flashes, if we want to transform ourselves, then we need to develop right view. So lastly, in the last part of my talk, are you still with me? I know I'm going on. You're still with me. Okay. So in the last part of my talk, I want to talk about what happens when we do go beyond all view. All view. Because another set of conditioned laws starts to operate. Another niyama comes into play, if you like. And it's called the Dharma niyama. And the Dharma niyama is a set of conditioned relations or laws that applies to spiritual development. It applies to, particularly, those spiritual practitioners who have decisively glimpsed the truth, who have perhaps glimpsed the radiance of the sun, and are never again going to be convinced of the darkness that they inhabit. They've glimpsed something, and once they've glimpsed it, the sun sort of beckons to them. And even if they find themselves lost in darkness, they can't help but move towards the light. That law of unfolding is the Dharma niyama. It's what enables us to become Buddhas. It's what enables the spiritual life to happen. So what we have to do is work on the karma niyama process, work on our minds to the best of our ability. Through ethics and meditation we can refine our consciousness, make it more positive, make it more integrated, make it more subtle, malleable, receptive. And then perhaps something of this other process will touch us. It's said that something starts to emerge in the mind that feels like it's coming from outside of us. It's so foreign to us, so unlike anything else, that it feels like it's nothing to do with us, and yet it touches us and consumes us in a certain sense. Enlightenment, I don't know what it's like. I don't know what it's like, but I like to think of it as the largest possible perspective. This is how Sangharakshita describes it. It's the widest, broadest, deepest possible perspective on our experience. And this notion, this image of the sun in the infinite cosmos, captures in my imagination something of that vast perspective. Carl Sagan again. National boundaries are not evident when we view the earth from space. Fanatical ethnic or religious or national chauvinisms are a little difficult to maintain when we see our planet as a fragile blue crescent fading to become an inconspicuous point of light against the bastion and citadel of the stars. That cosmic perspective gives, in a way, a perspective to the everyday. It gives us perspective on who we are. And it allows us to glimpse what we could be if we didn't limit ourselves with all the petty ways that we identify ourselves. Nationality is one of them, race is another, gender is another. You can think of so many, can't you? Profession, career, name, religion even. We identify ourselves and limit ourselves with these shackles. Carl Sagan has this model where the whole of the cosmos, 15 billion years of it, if you imagine it compressed into a single year starting from the 1st of January, then he says that the Milky Way didn't really form until May. Other planetary systems appeared in June, July and August. Our Sun and Earth came around mid-September. And human beings, all recorded history, at least, of human beings, is so recent that it occupies only the last few seconds of the last minute of December the 31st. Yeah. Isn't that fantastic? And that's the perspective. If I could remember that a little bit more, I wouldn't worry about our van breaking down in Banbury. Do you know what I mean? It would change things for me. So I think if we're going to continue to evolve, if we're going to continue to survive as a species, at all actually, we're going to have to go beyond our self-interests. We're all going to have to go beyond our self-interests. And we have to learn to leave behind the petty, small ways that we identify and limit ourselves. And when we do that, if we've developed our minds in the way that Buddhism suggests, then we'll start to get a glimpse of who we really are, what we really are. We'll know ourselves as if for the first time. And what we'll find is mysterious. It's difficult to put into words. We'll find something like, I'm going to give it a go, that we're an evolving process in an evolving cosmos, a temporary flowing vortex of energy, a whirling centre of form and consciousness that is of the same nature as the whole of the cosmos. And in this flow, not only are things not ultimately separate, there's actually no distinction between part and whole, because each centre of consciousness reflects all the others, as it were. It's as if every part contains the whole. I don't know what that means, but I intuit that it's true. If we let go of all ways of knowing, of all ways of clinging, if we let go, we find that somehow, in our consciousness, we contain the whole universe. In a sense, the whole of space and time, and all other consciousness. All things are like this. All things contain, in that sense, or reflect in some mysterious sense, all other things. Our common sense perceptions are deluded. They're wrong. And we can start to glimpse the truth through this faculty of imagination when applied to a mind that is lifted as high as reason can go, as high as positive emotion can go, as high as ethics can go. And when all distinctions disappear, what arises is compassion. What's said to arise is compassion. And it's not the sort of compassion that we normally feel in the metta bhavana, not this empathy between myself and another person, but a complete lack of distinction between self and other. And yet, this lack of distinction doesn't mean that we disappear into a soup. It doesn't mean that we all blend into one amorphous blob. Somehow, and I don't know what's going on, there is distinction. There is distinction. I'm giving this talk, you're not. There is distinction. And that is also part of the truth. But now this distinction isn't separateness. It's part of a play. It's part of a joyous, ceaseless dance of freedom and wonder and creativity and beauty that we call the cosmos. So I find this such an inspiring vision that I'm prepared to endure quite a lot of discomfort in order to move towards it. And I'm a comfort-loving creature, so I'm trying to emphasise how inspired I can feel by this vision. So I'm going to summarise now. If we're going to move towards this sort of vision, if we're going to actually transform our minds and evolve as individuals, then we need to recognise what limits us. One of the things that limits us is the views that we cling to out of our self-cherishing, out of our egotism. We need to look at those views clearly and courageously and be prepared to have them cut away from us. We need to refine and develop our consciousness through ethical practice, through metta, through awareness, through mindfulness, through meditation. And if we keep developing our minds in that way, and we keep working on cutting away unhelpful views, then at some point we will hear another voice. That's how it will feel. We'll hear another voice. And it won't be our voice, but it will be the most beautiful, kind voice that we've ever heard. And in a sense, it will be a voice that we recognise, that we kind of know, that we've been longing to hear all our lives. It is the gentle voice of Manchu Dosha that we'll hear. Sometimes we'll hear it as a whisper, sometimes it will be a mighty roar, shocking us into waking us up from our sleep. And we need to listen to that voice. We need to take it seriously. Even if it's a whisper and it only lasts a moment, it is the most important thing we'll ever hear in our lives. And we need not only to take it seriously, we need to act upon it. We have to have the courage to act, to fulfill what it is to be a human being. If we do that, if we do act upon that voice, we hear it, we listen to it, we act upon it, we'll, I believe, be able to open the book that he holds to his heart. That book is inviting us to read. It's inviting us into the deepest mystery that is the mystery of ourselves and of the whole cosmos. It's inviting us to enter into that mystery, to be touched by it, to be transformed by it. And if we let ourselves be touched and transformed, then we will have fulfilled what it is to be human. And perhaps if we do that, then one day we too will be worthy of wielding the flaming sword. And we too will be worthy of picking up and holding that perfection of wisdom to our heart. We'll become embodiments of the ideal that we've been striving for. At the end of the film, Sunshine, one man, he's the only man left alive, is still moving towards the sun. He's hurtling towards the sun. He is inside the bomb that needs to explode in the sun. He's found himself inside for plot reasons. And he's the last person that can do anything to save the sun, to save all life. He has to explode the bomb before he dies because he's hurtling into the sun. Space and time slow down for him because of the effect of the sun. And he manages to detonate this bomb. So behind him, this nuclear fusion starts to happen. And in the film, it's beautiful. It happens as stars, sparks that look like stars of light, starting a cascade behind him. And in front of him, this wall of flame enters into this chamber. This wall of flame that is also furious energy. So his hair is blown back. His mind is filled with the roar of this energy, this force. And it's blazing white. It's blazing white. And in the film, he looks at it. He looks at it. He stares at it. Not only does he look at it and stare at it, there's this ecstatic look of joy and freedom on his face, and he reaches his finger out to touch it. And he does. And the film ends. And I'm going to end. I just want to read you a very short four-line poem from the Sufi tradition by the poet Rumi, who I've come to really love. And Rumi is on the path of self-surrender, and he's given himself over to his teacher, who is determined to break the bonds that bind him to this limited self. He's determined to free him so that he can see the sun. Let me read you this. This is Rumi talking in sort of response to his teacher. I groaned. Be quiet, he said. I was quiet. He said, groan. I grew feverish. He said, be calm. I grew calm. He said, I want you to burn. Thank you.